Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Everyone, welcome to Mongolian Week. In this episode, we're going to be talking about something that was absolutely essential to the Mongolian Empire, the foundation of its military strength. Not just military strength, its form of transportation, its form of food, and when you get lonely out there on the steppe, its form of friendship. I am, of course, talking about the Mongolian horse. The Mongolian army's battle tactics depended on their sturdy, agile, and durable horses. With their Mongol horses and compound bows, the Mongolian armies conquered lands from China to Hungary, from northern India to Russia. The Mongolian armies revered their horses and took care of them. Every soldier had 4 to 6 horses, and he would switch from riding one to another during a day's campaign, ensuring that no one horse was ridden to exhaustion. This greatly enhanced the Mongol army's mobility. They could and did travel great distances, often covering 60 to 100 miles in one day. Because of this unheard mobility, no other army could match them. And that's why in chronicles and accounts, when kingdoms and states are being attacked by the Mongols, they think they're being attacked on multiple fronts at once when it's actually just one army. Also, this is something that Dan Carlin has mentioned in Hardcore History. When you look at itineraries of conquering armies in the ancient world, it's usually a very simple line versus the Wehrmacht in World War II when there's multiple attacks at once. This is what the Mongols look like. There's multiple lines of attack. They move very quickly, and it's hard to find anything comparable in the ancient world. Mongol battle tactics stemmed from their nomadic lifestyle. They spent their lives on horseback, herding and hunting. These skills easily transferred to warfare. The Mongolian army trained every day in horsemanship, archery, hand-to-hand combat, and in battle formations and drills. Their generals tried to anticipate every possible enemy move and then train their soldiers to counter those moves. All Mongol warriors and their horses received this constant training, making them the most disciplined fighting force in the world at the time. In contrast, medieval European armies only had a few trained professional soldiers, the knight and men-at-arms. The rest were farmers, peasants, and blacksmiths who were required to fight by feudal laws, but received only a day or two of training. Now, a Mongolian horse was more than just a means of transportation. It was also a source of food to its rider, due to the Mongolian appetite for cooked horse meat and kumis, fermented horse milk. Mongolian horses were smaller than their European counterparts and slower over short distances. But the Mongolian cavalry was so lightly armored that they could still outrun their foes. Furthermore, these horses were durable over long distances, enabling their army to achieve far-flung victories. This also made the provisions necessary for a Mongolian army to wage attacks a fraction of that required by more sedentary enemies in China, Iran, the Middle East, and Europe. Beyond the abilities of the horse, it was a soldier's connection to their horse. A Mongolian cavalryman had a deep kinesthetic understanding of his horse. When a horse is galloping, there's a moment when the horse is airborne and all 4 hooves are off the ground. In that split second, as he sat in a saddle and sailed through the air in smooth flight, he could shoot his arrow with enough accuracy to hit his target. I'm only going to say a little bit about Mongolian archery ability because I'm going to talk more about battle tactics in a future episode. But from a very young age, a Mongolian boy had to learn to master the Mongolian bow. The drawstring of the Mongolian bow was covered with so many layers of sinew that it had the pull of approximately 160 pounds, so it could fire an arrow 500 yards. And Mongolian archers were arguably the finest soldiers to ever handle a bow and arrow. Young boys began using these weapons on a nearly daily basis for hunting animals and wildlife. They learned to draw the bow and shorten their reaction times. Soon, the action of knocking an arrow, drawing the bow, and firing could be done in one smooth motion that took less than a second. They could pick off targets with perfect accuracy from 50 yards. Stories of skilled archers tell of them hitting targets 500 yards away, a distance that could treble a modern sharpshooter with a scope. Mongols had their own technique for shooting, known as the Mongolian release. If right-handed, they kept their bow in the left hand, pushed it forward as the right arm pulled the string all the way back to behind the ear. With the left arm fully extended, they held the string during the drawing of the bow on the pad of their thumb, with the index finger curling around it for support, and the other finger also being curled, forming a fist. Since 160 pounds is impossible to hold comfortably, Mongolian archers wore a thumb ring to protect the thumb's pad from damage as the finger released the drawstring. Each soldier carried two bows while on horseback, one for long-range archery, another for short distances. They had two quivers for arrows that served different purposes. These types of arrows included incendiary arrows for setting buildings on fire, whistling arrows for signaling, and armor-piercing arrows with a heavy arrowhead of tempered steel. Each soldier carried approximately 60 arrows. It was said, according to domestic and foreign chroniclers, that rank-and-file archers could hit the wings off of birds. Let me just mention a couple of favorite battle tactics. One of the favorite tactics was feigned retreat. The Mongols' use of the feigned retreat could take two paths. The first path involved a small force of Mongols charging the enemy, then turning and running, leading the enemy into an ambush. The second was to retreat as if routed, luring the enemy troops into following for days. The Mongols would stay just ahead of the enemy until they found a battlefield they liked. Then the Mongols would turn and begin their next favorite battlefield tactic, and that was encirclement. When an enemy followed a feigned Mongol retreat, it was easy for troops to become strung out over a distance. When the Mongols turned to the attack, the light cavalry would swiftly ride down the flanks of the enemy to the rear and encircle them. The Mongols stayed out of reach of the enemy and rained arrows down on them. When the enemy soldiers in disarray, the heavy cavalry would move in for the kill, going in close quarters to attack with lances. The Mongol army that conquered such a huge amount of territory owed their winnings to their horse and accurate use of the bow. Now that's not to say, of course, that the Mongols invented the feigned retreat. This was something that was known on the steppes long before the Mongols came onto the scene. Parthian horse archers annihilated the Romans at the Battle of Carrhae in 53 BC, and a certain number of Chinese armies at the same time also suffered under this technique. And nomad horse archers were always the ideal military force to conduct lightning-quick hit-and-run raids into territory of settled cultures. The purpose and mode of operation of these raids was to employ surprise and mobility to inflict a lot of damage, snatch up loot, and then vanish back into the steppes again. But it's not like this technique could conquer any force. For the most part, it was never the purpose of a raid to linger on settled culture ground and take on settled cultures in a head-to-head fight. But when the nomads came off the steppe and into home territories of settled cultures for the purpose of permanent conquest, they found the power of their style of war diluted. Swift, free-ranging maneuvers by masses of horse warriors are easy on the flat, treeless, wide-open hard ground of the steppe. But such maneuvers are restricted on ground that is cut up by irrigation ditches, villages, woodlots, forested hills, and mountains and sodded rice paddies. Whether at the Korean eastern end or the European western end of the steppe, nomad warriors encounter terrain that compel them to fight in ways which they were unaccustomed. A significant logistical problem that became more aggravated for nomad armies the farther they got off the steppe was a lack of wide-open pasturage on which to graze their thousands of horses. And with large cavalry forces, there are hundreds of thousands of horses, so you need a lot of grass. A consistently intractable problem for nomad would-be conquerors of settled cultures, confronted by a walled city, was to surround it, cut off food supplies to it, set up camp, and wait for the defenders of the city to starve. Among the horse nomads, only the Mongols of Genghis Khan and his successors fully mastered the military problem of walled cities. And I will talk about that more in tomorrow's episode about what were the specific tactics of the Mongolians that allowed them to accomplish things that other horse nomadic cultures couldn't. Well, thank you so much for listening. As I continue talking about Mongolian civilization, if any of you would like me to talk about another civilization, I welcome your comments, and you can send them to me by email at info@historyonthenet.com or voicemail at historyunpluggedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
We all know that hard times create hard men create good times create soft men create hard times. That's how the cycle of history works, right? Well, as guest Dan Carlin explains, that's not exactly the case.
You had mentioned, you know, what we had talked about with Kennedy being elected because, you know, who did better with the debate or who's going to lower my taxes or all these banal things 2 years before 100 million plus people are killed in a thermonuclear war, right? Did you elect the right guy then?
To listen to more of this History Unplugged interview with Dan Carlin about why the end is always near, search for History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice. Are you a man who thinks about the Roman Empire at least once a day? According to a recent internet meme, you definitely do. And why shouldn't you? Here's a clip from Tom Holland talking about Rome at the very height of its power.
When tourists go to the Colosseum, they're not really going there, I suspect, most of them, because they're admirers of Flavian architecture. I suspect that they're going there because it's the kind of the shiver that you get of going to a place where blood sports have happened.
To listen to more of this discussion, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice.